Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can Save Us podcast brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I'm Paul David, one of your co-hosts.
And I'm Maya Darren-Paul Hornby, your other co-host.
Today, we've got a great episode for you. This is our election episode. We're talking about helping to lead tech companies and navigate them through the election with Gaurav Bansal, who's the executive director of the Responsible Innovation Labs. Welcome to the pod, Gaurav.
Thanks for having me.
I mean, this is a very timely episode. We've got the election coming up in less than a month right now in the U.S. And we want to dig into the work that you're doing at Responsible Innovation Labs. And what you do is you work with high-growth tech startups and leading VCs, folks like General Catalyst, Lux, Mayfield, IVP, and many other big names to make responsible innovation on an essential mindset and operating norm in early stage company building. So RIL, which is for short Responsible Innovation Labs, you advance your mission by sharing best practices with startups, investors, generating content for purpose-built startups, building community, and informing public policy. Does that sound like a good summary of what you do?
Yeah, you got it right on.
One big thing we're going to talk about today is your responsible AI framework. That's one big resource that you've all pushed out, something that that companies are using, investors are using, to kind of tackle this critical question of how to innovate responsibly within the constraints that startups often face when they're fighting to survive. The framework distills best practices, tools, and resources that founders and operators can implement based on their circumstance and maturity as an enterprise. And that's a really key one, right? To like help folks on different levels of maturity innovate responsibly. So thank you for your work on that.
Well, we appreciate it. Thank you. We will keep working on it.
Before joining Responsible Innovation Labs, Gaurav served as a deputy assistant to President Obama, a venture and startup lawyer, and a managing director of a family office focused on philanthropic and traditional investments in order to strengthen public interest technology, American democracy, and economic inclusion. Welcome to the pod, Gaurav.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's jump in and let's talk a bit about how Responsible Innovation Labs defines the art and science of responsible innovation. Just give our audience a high level understanding of what responsible innovation is, because it's kind of a buzzword out there.
Yeah, we think of it as mindset and method at a high level. I think if you talk to a lot of people, particularly, certainly in tech, even in civil society, if you ask somebody what responsible means, often we talk about what is being built. Maybe it's something to combat climate change. Maybe it's something in the realm of biosciences, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of focus on what. You also see increasingly, for good reason, a lot of focus on who gets to build. Obviously, particularly in the States, early stage tech is not exactly, I should say, we have a lot of work to do, right, to make sure that the workforce, leadership, even frankly, both on the company building side, but also on the investment side, reflects the demography of our great country. We have a long way to go to achieve that. So there's a lot of focus on who, a lot of focus on what. And our view is responsible innovation is so much about the how. What's the methodology? What's the mindset that you go to navigate very hard decisions, frankly, that you have to make? I think part of the challenge for early stage operators is you don't know what ideas are going to take off. You don't know where the market will respond to what you're building. You may have this idea of a product and the market fit, as people say, but then you need really you need your own navigation system, frankly, to get you from one hard decision to another. And that mindset, that navigation system is something we're really keen on helping founders, operators, and investors to develop. So it's less a destination, less an outcome, and more of a consistent approach. We've been calling it sort of like a sound startup mindset that you go into various parts of your operations.
I'd be curious, like we talk on the podcast with a lot of founders in different sectors, so climate tech, health tech, HR tech, fintech. And one thing that comes up for us a lot is how responsible innovation varies from sector to sector. So we'd love to hear your perspective on how you've seen responsible innovation fall sector to sector and how maybe it differs a bit.
Well, you're right. I think, and certainly that we'll come back to the responsible AI framework in a little bit, but it's certainly maturity matters, stage matters. You don't have the resources when you're maybe a pre-seed company, as you do when you're a Series C or D, et cetera, et cetera. So stage matters, sector matters. Are you operating within a regulated industry or sector of the economy? Are you subject to perhaps rules in the EU or UK that you are not in the US? So it's certainly not a one-size-fits-all approach. And we're very cognizant of that. And hence, again, the need to have an approach that is flexible, that you can tailor to your surroundings. It's also very specific to, you know, I will say, so much of startups is narrative, right? So a lot of it is also the project you're undertaking. We have, I'll credit one of the co-founders of RAL, has a great expression that founders need to build a foundation for the weight of the project they're pursuing. Responsible innovation is really so much about that. For example, Stripe, which is where two of our co-founders came from, right? They're seen as a payments company, but their project is really more about building the economic infrastructure for the internet. If that's your project, it's going to demand a certain extra on your part from a responsible innovation point of view. It's also a regulated industry. So I think that you can see the direction that Stripe has taken, and I think widely considered to be one of the best companies, one of the best startup stories out there. You could go down through other examples as well, but I think it depends on your project, the impact you're trying to achieve, and the sector and circumstances you're in. I think what we encourage founders to do and think about is, what is your project? You often are pushed to think about your product and your market, which is, of course, like an essential first step. If you're really aspiring to build something huge, you probably are doing some sort of project. One of the great privileges of this role is you just get to meet amazing founders and investors and people sort of looking out into the future. And I think, look, I've been in politics, I've been in government. That's one way to change the world. It's a very important way in a democratic society to engage. These builders are sort of pursuing change in a different way. At least most are, not all, but most are. And they have a particular thesis of what they think the world should look like. And they're pursuing it through their company, through their startup. And so again, I think there is a project. It's some are bigger than others. And certainly part of the reason we exist is we feel this is a force, right? I mean, to state the obvious, technology is a force shaping this world. And therefore, founders in particular have a great responsibility to do so, impact the world responsibly. We've heard, if I could add one more thing, you know, I've certainly heard from some less enthusiastic founders and operators that I've been told, you know, I'm a responsible person, and why would I need responsible innovation labs? And it's just fair. Like, that's true. It's great. It's a great starting point to have personal integrity and responsibility. And I think most founders and operators wake up every day wanting to do good things to the world and in the world. No one's waking up to be irresponsible. Maybe a few people are, but generally that's not who we hang out with. But that doesn't necessarily scale. Your own sense of responsibility doesn't scale, right? So I think part of, again, this mindset and method is, how do we give founders the tools to ensure that that shows up in operating norms and in governance?
Yeah, you just touched on it, but I would love to hear a bit more about the sort of thesis and worldview behind the project that is Responsible Innovation Labs. And connectedly, you just mentioned the problem of scaling and scaling responsibly. But what problems do early stage tech companies, their founders and their investors face in the States?
Again, I think let's come back to let's assume good intent, which we try to do. Founders and investors are trying to build a business, first and foremost, right? They're trying to build a business that's scale, that's venture backable in most cases. And that brings with it a set of challenges, right? Often around the technology, around the go-to-market strategy. We can go down the list of all the things you've heard before. And there's a sort of, I would call it indifference towards this idea of responsible innovation. I think from a values perspective, everyone will nod their heads and say, yeah, of course that matters. But we've found that there's a bit of a practice gap. Founders, and this sort of dovetails with this question of the particular challenges, it's not like there is a playbook, right? It depends on the sector. It depends on, frankly, the experience level of the founder, right? You have a lot of younger founders for whom this is their biggest project. It's a real thing. And they may not have worked. If you're a repeat founder, you maybe have a better sense of what you to do and not do. But then again, if you're building an AI, which is, you know, in some ways undiscovered territory commercially, there's not a lot of signposts and guardrails. So this idea of the practice gap is one that we are trying to contribute to solving for. Our hope is that by working with founders and operators, we will build a body of knowledge that can be applied and other founders coming behind them can draw on. right? Those experiences. So how do we close that practice gap? How do we build that community around this thesis? Those are two really, really important things for us. And frankly, how do we serve as a voice just to advocate for it, both within the tech community, but frankly, within policy circles as well? Our job is to make responsible innovation table stakes for how you build a great company going forward. How do you become a great leader? Responsible innovation has to be synonymous with those things. To your other question around what are the challenges? I mean, one, again, there's so much pressure to achieve product market fit. I don't have time. My mind share is so limited. I'm just fighting to survive. Right. I can hear those words because I hear them all the time and have deep empathy for the, it's such a lonely and exhausting experience, particularly to be a founder. And so when somebody comes along, whether it's me, an investor, somebody in government comes along and says, hey, you know, we need you to be responsible. I think it's easy for many founders to kind of retreat and say, yeah, I'll worry about it later. Or I don't have the resources of Meta or Google. Ask them to do it. Don't look at me. And I think our job is, particularly at RAL, is how do we frame responsible innovation within the business problem that they're experiencing? How do you use it to attract the best talent? How do you use it to build trust with the customer so you can close a deal? How do you use it to get ahead of the risks that are lurking around the corners? Inevitably, tech these days is under increased scrutiny, and that's coming for everybody, any startup of consequence. And so this idea of responsible innovation, in our view, connects to the lived experience of founders, and we just have to walk them through it and meet them where they are.
And I guess providing them with a narrative that connects them to other founders in terms of a wider mission.
I can't claim that yet. We're pursuing that. But no one wants to do things by themselves. And it's, in some ways, it's very countercultural what RAL is doing. The dominant culture of the Valley is to not worry about this. Let's be honest. And for a countercultural place, that's the conventional wisdom. And we're bringing our countercultural view to the Valley and elsewhere.
Stepping back a bit to the sort of U.S. political context, the United States has yet to develop a comprehensive, overarching legislative framework similar to the EU's AI Act. But instead, the Biden administration, they've issued an executive order and relied on voluntary commitments from large LLMs and started to engage in testing of these high-capacity models. And some of the agencies may also take specific actions within their jurisdictional domains. But love if you could explain to our audience the lay of the land in Washington.
I'll do my best. And of course, it's a very timely question. I think certainly there's a lot of focus for good reason on the U.S. presidential election with respect to tech policy. I think there are many good reasons to focus on our presidential election. I have cautioned, you know, people in our domain and vicinity, to not put every marble in the basket of that election. There are other reasons to do that. But I think for tech policy in particular, a better place to look is Congress, to the legislative branch, maybe even to the judicial branch, in terms of near term, what's about to happen. So I don't want to spend too much time looking at what would a President Harris do or what would a President Trump do? Those are important questions. But I think if you look at Congress, I think there's a couple of strands of thought worth focusing on. One is it's clear in Washington, D.C. that I think you would call them the effective altruist cohort crowd. I don't know what you call them, have invested a great deal of money in infrastructure in Washington, D.C. That shows up in the narrative. I mean, I was just in Washington, D.C. last week, and you can tell which groups have come through before you because people kind of tell you back the sort of talking points they've heard. And I don't say that like with cynicism. I mean, I think people hear who comes through, and it's clear the effective altruists have brought their worldview to Washington, D.C. in a major, major way. So I think that's one strand of thought that you hear. Obviously, people are very focused on competition with China. In some ways, it's a, I don't want to say a great unifier across party lines, but it's certainly one that has a lot of traction. And that cuts in a lot of different directions. I think the direction it's cutting right now is it's too early to put any regulatory guidelines and perceived clamps on AI. And part of the reason given for that is sort of competition, great power competition with China. So, and then I think, but you know, the third just trend, I think this has become more of a trends exercise in answering your question, is there is a bit of hangover around social media. This is like sort of common in the US where it's like, well, it's too early, so we can't we shouldn't do anything. And then inevitably there are winners, and those winners amass incredible power in our political economy. And then it's very hard to do something. Again, part of the thesis for us to exist is some of this companies have to do on their own within their own culture. There's only so much that even a strong legislative body can impose. So I think between the social media hangover, great power competition with China, effective altruists, there's just a lot of different incoming that even members and their staffs are making sense of. Obviously, they're all waiting to see what happens with the presidential election. But I think you have a lot of members who've taken to heart this is a pretty powerful technology in AI, and therefore there's a lot of learning going on. Actually met many staffers and members I've talked to are quite, you know, informed and thoughtful. And our job is to help them see another sort of side of this.
I would just like to hear a bit more specifically about effective altruism, investing in infrastructure in DC, and with it bringing their worldview. How is that discernible to you visiting Washington?
I think what I sense is there's a focus for many in that philosophy of catastrophic harm, I think if you looked at SB 1047 in California, which your listeners may or may not have followed earlier this year, that was a bill with very good intent. I think the state senator behind it was a very well-intended bill. But the starting place, at least when it was first released, was very much on this catastrophic harm. As I traveled DC, and you know, as we do our own thinking, I think you can think of harms at least in two ways, maybe three ways. I think there's a lot of near-term harms from technology like AI, whether it's companies are already using it, right? Maybe it's to determine my credit worthiness. Maybe it's to look at my resume for job applications, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think there's people need to be aware of what those sort of applications of AI are. Colorado, the state in the U.S., has passed a bill sort of along those lines around this quote consequential decisions. So that's a very near-term form of harm. And then I think, again, the effective altruist crowd is much, my sense is, again, they don't really engage with us, but is much more focused on the sort of world-ending side of things. And so to your question, Maya, around DC, I mean, if that's all people tell you when you're meeting with them of what they're worried about, either they are of that philosophical persuasion, or certainly they seem to have been persuaded by it. And so, and then you can see in sort of public filings, there are 501c3, which are nonprofit organizations, 501c4 advocacy organizations under the US tax code. And you can see that they sprout up with these names. I've worked in DC. There's a particular playbook that gets played.
And do you think that there is a sort of vacuum in policymakers' education about emerging technologies that makes these sort of long-term harms so dominant in their thinking about how to...
Yeah. Well, I don't want to pick on EA actually the biggest narrative driver around AI in Washington, D.C. are large tech companies. And whether it's, you know all the names, right? But they come to town all the time. They have armies of lobbyists at their disposal. They have enormous power. And I think big tech is the one driving a lot of the narrative around AI. And I think I want to be careful how I say this. I mean, I think certainly if you're a member of Congress, you care deeply about competition geopolitically. And so certainly those large tech companies are very important. But I think there's a great danger in having large tech companies set the rules of the road and the narrative around an emerging technology like AI. We worry about that quite a bit. We think it's really important for startups to be able to compete. So when we think about policy, I think we have an eye for, are these proposed rules ones that are just going to entrench existing power in the name of safety, or are they going to both achieve safety and transparency and what other worthy policy goals along with spurring competition? I think that's where we differ perhaps from some of our big tech colleagues.
And so how does that approach inform the responsible AI playbook?
I think we set out to build the responsible AI playbook for, I would say, two reasons. One is, coming back to where we started, there is very little existing resource purpose-built for startups. So if you look in the US context, there's a sub-agency of the Department of Commerce, the NIST. NIST has a framework, risk management framework, which is, I think, a really good work, a very positive contribution to the ecosystem. It's also like, I don't know, 80 to 100 pages long. And your average startup founder does not have the cognitive mindshare to go read that and figure out how to apply that to his or her circumstances. So part of what we set out to do is like, we should just put our view out there. We should try to do it in a way that's a little bit more digestible for startups. And so we put out version one last November. We got some great feedback on it, candidly. And so we put out version two in July. So I think we will keep trying to evolve that as we learn more, as we hear more from founders and operators. We worked with some investors on that. We built a cross-sector, you know, volunteer committee of operators, founders, investors to develop both of these modules over time. So the first reason was like, how do we give startups something? Because there wasn't very much out there. And again, I think the second reason was the idea that startups should do something, that it's really hard to retrofit for responsibility. And we want to encourage startups to get on an escalator where as they evolve, as they mature, they can take on more and more. But like, let's start in a reasonable place for where they're situated. But that everyone has a role to play.
And what sort of feedback have you had on it?
I think certainly from investors, we've heard more because I think investors are also trying to get their arms around, like, how do we do this? How do you do it in diligence? How do you do it, you know, evaluating risks? I think some firms are farther ahead than others, frankly. I won't name names, but some are much farther ahead. Then I think in your portfolio support, as if you're a more sophisticated venture fund, how do you incorporate this? And then on the governance side, that's maybe the most important is, I always have to dispel this notion for venture investors is, yes, perhaps there's a deal you won't make, but more often you're chasing deals. And it's really, what do you do when you have the board seat? What do you do with the influence you have? And, you know, have you all seen like the Spider-Man meme on the internet where all like the Spider-Men are pointing at each other, right? So it's a bit like that where the ecosystem now is like, well, the investors look, well, I don't really have influence on the founder. And I'm like, and then, you know, founders are like telling me, well, make my investors care. And then the LPs are saying, well, like, you know, make the VCs do it. And, you know, we have a collective action problem here. We have five decades of habits that have deprioritized responsibility, which maybe made sense in an earlier generation when you weren't building such world-changing technology. But this is a different era. This is a different mindset. So we have to evangelize that mindset. You know, when you try to bring a different worldview, you certainly get some negative feedback, which we certainly heard. Again, I won't name names, but we've heard, I would say it's less constructive, sort of the get off my lawn variety. But that's like just not really the real world. And fundamentally, I'll come back to what I said, like this is about helping companies build great businesses. And it's not like a moral exercise. I mean, as much as I may want it to be, it's not. Companies are going to encounter very hard decisions that implicate business, technology, responsible innovation, ethics, values, whatever you want to call it, and giving founders the tools to navigate, it's really, really important. No one is serving founders by just saying, don't worry about it, because they're going to have to make those hard calls. And if you're a founder listening to this podcast, you just call it. Reach out. We'll be happy to talk to you about how we think about those things. So there was less constructive feedback. There was investors kind of figuring out how to apply it in their circumstances. And I think founders we've talked to, some are already doing it. And I think they're often exceeding what we say in our framework, which is great to see. And then we have to get them to talk about it. You know, I think they don't want the attention, but you have to show the marketplace, the customers that you're doing it. You have to explain that in a really quick way. If you go to cyber, if I can divert for a second, every company will say, I have my SOC 2 certification, right? Nobody like blinks an eye. Everybody goes through it. It doesn't mean you'll have zero risk, but it shows that you're proactive. You've gone through a set of actions to give yourself a shot at preventing harm. And hopefully our framework, it could be somebody else's framework, does the same, right? It gives you a shot to prevent harm, to build good product, serve your customers.
With the election approaching, the potential for emerging technologies like AI, deepfakes, and advanced social media algorithms to influence democratic processes is a growing concern. The US has a long history of voter manipulation and disenfranchisement, from gerrymandering to misinformation campaigns in more recent years. How do you think we should approach analyzing the potential interference of these technologies after the election is held? And how can we ensure that tech innovation is used responsibly to protect rather than to undermine the integrity of future elections?
You're right. We have a history that we have to account for. In some ways, we have to atone for it. And this is sort of unfortunate through line in American politics of winning by disenfranchising. And so I think to your question of how do we know, I think we should see the most famous endorsement of the cycle was Taylor Swift, perhaps saying, coming out to say in response to essentially misinformation, she's endorsing Vice President Harris. But I think what I'll be paying attention to is, we'll go into the voter file, which is the database of voters. And, I think people will be doing a lot of analysis post-election around who won. Was it about vote switching? Did certain people stay home and not vote at all? Who are they? Where do they live? What were they exposed to? And I think there'll be a bit of sort of forensic analysis, if you will, looking back to see. And I think if we look at more recent scandals, I don't know if you want to call it that, but where it was clear certain tactics, legal or unscrupulous as they may be, often you have that forensic analysis playing the role to let you know. And then, as is often the case, platforms will be slow to catch up. I think we're seeing an unfortunate trend where certainly a lot of the big social media platforms have deprioritizing the response to these trends, these pressures, sometimes for political reasons and sometimes for ideological reasons. So I worry. I am worried. I think it feels like it's inevitable that something will happen. Which way it cuts, it's unclear. Who's to be held responsible? Unlikely to happen. But hopefully there will be some deep analysis coming in the weeks and months ahead that give us some clues on how we should combat this.
How much of this do you think is, it just shocks me that we know a lot of the issues. We can, we've seen this happen before, but we're almost like expecting something to go wrong. And how much of this do you think ties back to maybe just a lack of coherent regulation around what these platforms can and can't do?
Yeah, I mean, I love my country and we don't run elections in a very sane way, particularly presidential elections. They're almost 2 years long. They're overrun with money, ads on ads. I mean, look, I think we have mis and disinformation even in our TV ads. And I think that's a regulated, those have some form of regulation. And I think there's a larger problem with our politics. AI is not AI is just the latest manifestation of it. So I'm not saying I disagree on, or at least I think it's worth a conversation on what could be a coherent regulatory package around political advertisements. I think that's a worthy conversation. I also just think we have a larger cultural challenge on our hands in terms of the sort of combative nature of our politics. And, when I was on the Hill last week, I spent more time with Republicans. I worked for President Obama, as you noted earlier. Spent more time with Republicans last week. You get them in these quiet moments, and there's a lot of room to find alignment. To find common purpose. Our politics don't reflect that at the moment. So I don't mean to demur. I think I struggle with that question. And as somebody who's thought of voting rights and voter protection, we certainly have to show up and be ready to combat that type of misinformation in the weeks ahead, because this is where people are most vulnerable. But we have a lot of work to do.
It's a great segue to kind of our next question, which is kind of like what happens after November 5th. And I think that's sort of really important. Like it's almost kind of like, look, the election is going to be where it's going to be. And then we need to get to the work of, sort of like governing and sort of regulating ourselves, self-regulating as a people culturally. Come the morning of November 6th, what will the Responsible Innovation Lab be doing to kind of ensure that the incoming government, whoever it may be, will kind of cultivate that conducive environment for the responsible deployment of emerging tech? Like what happens on sort of really, kind of day one, but also, when the new administration comes in January as well?
I think the first thing we'll do, do some meaning making for our own community. So I think that's both sort of certainly on what it means for responsible innovation, but it means more generally for the innovation ecosystem. I think you'll have a White House that could either be very different from what the Biden administration is doing, or one that will most likely have some continuity, albeit chart a different course. So I think, one, we have to do some meaning making. Two, I think for our perspective, our job is to, again, keep showing up. Part of the reason I was in Capitol Hill last week was just introduce the thesis of what we're doing. So I will go back. I will go do that. We will lean on our friends and allies to help us with that mission. We'll encourage investors and startups to do the same. And then three, I think I'll come back to Congress and state capitals, right? I think certainly the executive branch in the U.S. system will have a lot of power through executive order, government procurement, any number of levers at their disposal. So we will definitely show up in that space. A lot of the discussion will move to Congress around these same issues. My sense is Congress is looking for voices other than big tech to help it shape the course of what comes next. So in that sense, we're not the only ones, but I think it's important for us to be there with other startup voices and early stage tech voices. So that's one thing we'll do. And then I think there's a world in which you have to also look at state capitals in our federal system, that I can imagine a world that if Donald Trump wins, states will decide, you know, so-called blue states will decide that they need to do something about AI because they perceive the federal government may or may not do something. Vice President Harris wins, maybe so-called red states will do something else. So I think we have to be aware of what's happening at multiple levels of government based on what happens. Certainly a lot of the action will be in DC. And then I would say, not to overcomplicate, but I think I am, I think another place we have to look is multilateral institutions and conversations, right? We already have the EU obviously implementing its AI Act. We're going to have more AI safety summits. In November, the AI safety institutes from around the world are gathering in San Francisco just this year, right after the election. So I think, how do you, if you're a startup, like how on earth are you going to comply with all of these various rules when you don't have the armada of lawyers and PhDs that Meta or Google or others have? And so I think if we care about innovation and competition, I think we have to really look at how a startup can reasonably navigate regimes that may or may not be aligned. So getting some rules of the road in place for startups to compete is really, really important. So I think it is like five-dimensional chess or four-dimensional chess at minimum. And I think startups, we have our work cut out for us, but important that we show up and be heard. And I mean, again, this comes back to like this, hopefully the simplicity of our mission is certainly people need to abide by the law. And the one thing startups can control is what their own mindset, their own navigation system, and their own responsible innovation program is. You can do that. And often that can be good enough. Acting in good faith is a pretty good start. And so what we encourage founders and operators to do, and investors even, is like, you know, it's easy to get overwhelmed by everything happening out there. Do the thing that you can control in your own house. It doesn't have to be perfect. We can't expect you to do what Meta does. Do something. And our responsible AI framework gives you some, you know, a menu of things to choose from. Seek out help, right? I think go to values aligned people, whether it's your investors, if they're values aligned, whether it's RIL, whether it's something else, go find people to help you. You don't have to do this by yourself. So I think that's sort of the plea and urgency we feel. Don't let it happen to you. Do something in the name of your own customers and your own talent to get ahead.
And connectedly, what have you learned from disruptions businesses operating in the States faced with the last change in government?
Well, I mean, certainly it seems like a different era, right? I think AI is so much in the zeitgeist now compared to November of 2020. And tech is doing relatively well, it seems. And I try not to say that as a political matter. I just think, like, if I look around the ecosystem, the United States continues to lead the world when it comes to AI, both as a field of study, but also, frankly, from a commercial point of view. So I don't know. I think the challenge around whiplash for companies is the executive branch is in one party's hands, and therefore there's a certain set of rules, and now it's in another set of hands, and then every 4 years you kind of switch it back and forth. That can be a dizzying. My message to Congress is try to give startups a fair chance to compete. Try to keep that as reasonably stable as possible. You mentioned earlier, there is existing authorities in a lot of these executive branch agencies. At minimum, give some clarity with the rules you have, the power you have. Use your grant-making dollars to try to encourage innovation. Invest in compute for educational institutions at minimum, if not for startups. So I think there's some things hopefully that are common sense, bipartisan things. But again, I think compared to 2020, we're in a very different world in terms of what's in the zeitgeist. And I think it'll be very interesting to see. Again, I think there'll be profound consequences of this election for so many issues. I think AI, there'll be some changes, but I think there'll be, given some of these other geopolitical concerns, I think there'll be more consistency is my suspicion going forward, at least for the near term. And I'll be honest, right? I think we're at the beginning of our work. We're up against, we picked a very steep mountain to climb, in the words of one investor I've talked to. We have to make responsible innovation table stakes, not just in the States, but frankly, for early stage innovators everywhere, will require behavior change. Certainly that's what we focus on a lot with our content and the coaching and best practices. We try to evangelize behavior change. There's culture change. There's also policy, which we've spent a lot of time talking about. And then incentives. I mean, we haven't talked about how LPs give incentives to the VCs they invest in around these issues. That is a huge lever for change. So if you're an LP listening to this, like, we should talk. I think VCs are of mixed approach right now on how much they want to make this an incentive or a requirement for their portfolio companies. So coming back to that Spider-Man meme, I think there's a role for everyone to play here, and we're gonna do our part. I'll just say what inspires me is there have been prior moments in recent history of capitalism where industry has raised its game, often because of pressure from the outside, let's be honest, right? But if we take the quality and manufacturing movement, which is one I refer to a lot, there was a time when you could build something, manufacture something, it would kill people, and people wouldn't bat an eye, which is crazy. No serious CEO today would say they don't care about quality. What did it take to get there? It took some cultural shifts within industry. It took a lot of pressure and policy from the outside. It took people paying attention. So I think, again, we have a very complex systems problem on our hands, and we're going to do our part to drive some of that systems change. But we're going to need a lot of help. So I hope your listeners will figure out where they fit in and decide how they can advance this cause as well.
Well, that's a great point to end on. And I can't think of a better guest to have to talk about, you know, leading tech companies to kind of navigate the next election. And also we talked about investors as well. It's been a fantastic conversation with Gaurab Bansal, the Executive Director of Responsible Innovation Labs. Gaurab, thank you for jumping on the pod. We really appreciate your time today.
Of course. Thank you.
Real quick for our listeners, where can folks find out more about the great work that you're doing at Responsible Innovation Labs?
Yeah, welcome people to come to our website, www.rilabs.org. I think you can send us your info there. We'd be happy to set up time to chat.
Nice. We'll drop that in the episode description. And we know you're a busy man, Gaurab, so thank you so much for taking the time, getting up early for us. And also for our listeners, please, please, please give us a review, give us a listen, give us a 5-star rating if you can, so we can get more fantastic guests like Gaurab onto Tech Can't Save Us podcast. As always, this is Paul David from Literal Humans. Thank you so much for tuning in to Tech Can't Save Us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.